They made the judgment that now is not the right time to travel. The president agreed with that. And that is when the president made the decision to send out some tweets announcing that decision.
That decision involves the U.S. Secretary of State's plan to go to North Korea. This is Thursday, August 30th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Remember, you can also join us and have some feedback for us on the VOA Asia Facebook page. Also ahead, Vietnam demands compensation from the manufacturers of Agent Orange. Myanmar rejects charges from the United Nations, and the Nobel Committee makes a decision on Aung San Suu Kyi's Peace Prize. That's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. media reports say that North Korea sent a letter to the United States last week warning that talks on denuclearization are at stake and may fall apart. According to those reports, harsh rhetoric in the letter prompted President Donald Trump to abruptly cancel the planned trip to Pyongyang by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, just hours before he was set to depart last Friday. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports from the State Department about the apparent impasse.
It was supposed to be Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's fourth trip to North Korea, but President Donald Trump abruptly pulled the plug in a tweet and accused China of not helping with the denuclearization talks. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert declined to confirm or deny the existence of a letter from North Korea that reportedly warns Trump that talks were on the brink.
The entire national security team discussed this. In their judgment, they made the judgment that now is not the right time to travel. The president agreed with that, and that is when the president made the decision to send out some tweets announcing that decision.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, said it's possible that North Korea has changed its mind on denuclearization, but says the U.S. will not change its mind on sanctions.
The positive is that we have sanctions that basically cut off 90% of their trade, 30% of their oil, and we're holding tight on those sanctions, so they still need financial relief and they're begging for it.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said he is coordinating closely with Secretary Pompeo about resuming joint military exercises with South Korea.
As you know, we took the step to suspend several of the largest exercises as a good faith measure coming out of the Singapore summit. We have no plans at this time to suspend any more exercises.
Senator Ben Cardin told VOA he supports Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un, but not ending the joint military exercises.
Well, I thought it was a mistake to end the military exercises in the beginning. I did not support that. I did support the meeting. I think in using diplomacy makes sense. But I don't think there should be concessions made to North Korea unless we see tangible results.
With talks apparently stalled, it is not clear when the world is likely to see the next images of another top-level meeting between the U.S. and North Korea. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
As you just heard, Secretary of State Jim Mattis announced that there are no more plans for suspending major joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises as a way to get North Korea to denuclearize. Pyongyang has denounced such exercises in the past as a prelude to invasion. President Donald Trump announced the suspension of those exercises following his meeting in Singapore with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. However, a lack of progress in ridding the North of its nuclear weapons prompted Mr. Trump last week to, as you just heard, cancel a fourth trip to Pyongyang by Secretary of State Pompeo. Robert Manning is a senior fellow and a security expert at the Atlantic Council. He told VOA's Victor Beatty military exercises are the glue of an alliance. If you don't train together, he added, you don't fight together.
We do two of those exercises a year, and I think what Secretary Mattis is implying is we need to keep our troops at the ready. At the same time, we've had reports, the IAEA report, that verified that North Korea is still working on its nuclear weapons program, its missile program. they have yet to take the first baby step towards denuclearization, which is to give the International Atomic Energy Agency a full declaration of the inventory of its nuclear weapons and facilities. If we don't have that, we have nothing in regards to denuclearization. And so I think there's a lot of frustration inside the administration, including privately Mr. Trump. And I think this was a way of signaling to North Korea the party's over.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in is expected to hold his third summit with the North Korean leader, this time in Pyongyang next month. Is the South Korean president out on a limb by himself now?
To his credit, I think President Moon has tried to carefully link North-South reconciliation process with progress in denuclearization. But the North Koreans are very skillful at trying to drive a wedge between the U.S. and South Korea, and that they've been moving forward on a number of issues, most recently on the divided family visits, which is a big emotional issue. President Moon agreed to do another summit. They've been doing a lot of planning for how to reintegrate roads and rails between the two Koreas and all these things, which is fine if you're laying out a vision for the future, but don't forget, we still have UN sanctions in place, so they really can't do very much. What the South Koreans are doing is trying to take the North-South process as far as they can while being faithful to a link to denuclearization. But the problem is that the denuclearization piece is frozen. What's happened is we haven't really had a negotiating process. They had a summit. They made vague declarations about denuclearization and peace regimes with no idea what follows or how to follow it up with the hard business of detailed negotiations. Then when Pompeo on his third trip last time basically just told the North Koreans, we want to get rid of 60 to 70% of your weapons in 6 to 8 months, which is a very tall order. And there was no indication of what the trade-off was. It was, you do this, and then maybe we'll lift sanctions afterwards. That's not going to happen. I think what you have to have is a reciprocal proportionate process. If we want them to do a lot of denuclearization up front, then we need to sit down with the Koreans and the other actors in Northeast Asia and figure out what the appropriate level of benefits would be if they gave us all that.
Robert Manning said this process of reciprocity should be done in coordination with other regional actors, including South Korea, Japan, China, and Russia, who stand ready to provide economic benefits to North Korea. He said that would build trust by showing sincerity between the U.S. and North Korea. He described U.S.-Korea policy as being at an inflection point where it could become a failure. You are invited to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. Here are the top stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. More than a dozen human rights groups are urging Google not to offer censored internet searches in China. That amid reports it's planning to again provide the service in that giant market. Police say rebels fighting against Indian rule ambushed a group of police officials and killed four of them Wednesday in the disputed Himalayan region of Kashmir. China denies an accusation by U.S. President Trump that it hacked the emails of Hillary Clinton, his Democratic opponent, in the 2016 election. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues now. Vietnam is demanding compensation from the manufacturers of Agent Orange in what experts describe as a last resort for helping citizens who still fall sick or face disabilities linked to the defoliant the United States used during war in the country 5 decades ago. The Vietnamese news outlet VN Express International reports the foreign ministry in Hanoi asked Thursday that Monsanto and other U.S. firms compensate victims of Agent Orange. American military aircraft use Agent Orange to clear jungles in Vietnam and expose enemy soldiers from 1961 through 1971. Experts say its residue dioxin is believed to be a risk factor for health problems. He says about 800,000 Vietnamese people get assistance now for illness and disabilities because of exposure. The latest demand was made after a U.S. jury ordered Monsanto to pay damages to an American cancer patient who claims that he was exposed to a weed killer produced by the same company. Vietnam once found it hard to get scientific evidence for showing the health impacts of Agent Orange, according to Carl Thayer, Southeast Asia's specialized emeritus professor at the University of New South Wales in Australia. He says Agent Orange remains volatile at some hot spots where it was stored during the war that ended in 1975.
Obviously, it's not as effective as before, but it's still deadly, or it still produces birth defects. And the issue in Vietnam are families who have children that feel they never were compensated or treated fairly.
Monsanto did not comment on these latest developments. Happening now in Asia, U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley says the Trump administration expects to see two Reuters journalists accused by Myanmar's government of illegally possessing official documents acquitted of all charges next week. A Myanmar judge postponed that verdict in the case of the two on Monday, saying it'll be announced on September 3rd. More than 5,000 people have evacuated their homes after water from a breached dam flooded communities in central Myanmar on Wednesday and blocked part of a highway linking the main cities of Yangon, Mandalay, and the capital of Naypyidaw. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are very happy you're with us on VOA Asia. Myanmar is rejecting the findings of a special United Nations investigative panel accusing the military of genocide and other human rights abuses during last year's crackdown against the minority Rohingya Muslims. A Myanmar government spokesman told state-run media Wednesday that we don't agree and accept any resolutions by the UN's Human Rights Council, which sanctioned the report because it refused to allow the investigators to enter the country. In a separate probe, the U.S. State Department says it gathered information from Rohingya Muslim refugees that substantiates accusations that the Myanmar military and security forces perpetrated atrocious human rights violations, including rape. The United States says its findings are based on more than 1,000 interviews with refugees in camps in Bangladesh, where Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar fled more than a year ago. The U.S. ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, told the Security Council Tuesday that the world is watching how it responds to the situation.
The difficult path toward democracy must continue in Burma and culminate in a military that is subordinate to the civilian government, not the other way around. Here in the Security Council, we must hold those responsible for violence to account. A responsive democratic government that respects the rights of its minorities will not emerge in Burma until the government demonstrates that it is committed to accountability.
Meanwhile, as many U.S. lawmakers in Washington call for action to be taken against Myanmar's civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi, the majority leader of the U.S. Senate, Mitch McConnell, maintains his support of the Nobel Peace Prize winner.
Here's the situation in Burma. The government is structured in such a way that the military has a set-aside in the parliament of 25% of it. As a result of the 25% military set-aside in the parliament, they cannot change a provision that allows Aung San Suu Kyi to actually be the real leader of the country. Put another way, she has very limited ability, if any at all, to direct the activities of the military. No one doubts that atrocities were committed against the Rohingyas, not in doubt. The question is it responsible to hold her responsible for something she cannot control? And so I've been reluctant to sort of join the pile-on that seeks to blame her for things that she couldn't possibly have had any impact on.
McConnell said on the Senate floor Thursday he had spoken with Aung San Suu Kyi and that she said she was working to get aid to the Rohingya Muslim areas in the Southeast Asian nation that were affected by violence. McConnell has had close ties to Suu Kyi for years. He said Aung San Suu Kyi, a Nobel Prize laureate and de facto head of the government in Myanmar, also known as Burma, told him when they spoke on Wednesday that violations of human rights would need to be addressed. And there was news from Norway on Wednesday as the Norwegian Nobel Committee announced that the Nobel Peace Prize to Aung San Suu Kyi will not be withdrawn in the light of a United Nations report that said Myanmar's military carried out mass killings of Muslim Rohingya. The committee said Aung San Suu Kyi won the Nobel Peace Prize for her fight for democracy and freedom up until 1991, the year she was awarded the prize. And the rules regulating the Nobel Prizes do not allow for a prize to be withdrawn. The Rohingya refugees now live in dire conditions in what is now the world's largest refugee camp in neighboring Bangladesh. The UN said conditions are not yet in place for them to return home in a safe, voluntary, and dignified manner. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. India's Supreme Court orders police to put five prominent rights campaigners suspected of links to Maoist guerrillas under house arrest as outrage grows over their detention. An Islamist party in Pakistan is calling for the expulsion of the Dutch ambassador as it launches a protest against a far-right Dutch politician's plan for a cartoon competition featuring caricatures of the Muslim prophet Muhammad. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, in the violence-racked Indian-administered state of Kashmir, photojournalists have been capturing the daily lives of people and telling their stories to the outside world for many a year. But the work is not without its dangers. 18 journalists and media personnel have been killed covering the three-decade-old armed conflict in the disputed Himalayan region. Like much of South Asia, the industry is predominantly staffed by men, but that's changing in recent years. Women have stepped up to join their ranks as working photojournalists. VOA's Yusuf Jamil spoke to some of the women who are challenging long-held societal norms and filed this report, narrated by Bezan Hamdard.
Being a journalist in a conflict zone is not an easy job. It's even more difficult if you happen to be a woman. The news media in South Asia, and especially in Indian-administered Kashmir, has traditionally been staffed by men. But a few brave women, including Sana Irshad, are changing the game.
So many things happen in Kashmir. It has a history of violence, and when you think of it, we're living it every day. So nothing is left untouched when it comes to suffering. Kashmir itself is an inspiration to me, that I can do something for myself and the people here. And the best medium that I found to achieve this is photography.
But the job comes with significant risks. 18 journalists have been killed in the region since 1989 while covering different events. But Irshad believes that despite the dangers, women can do the work as well as their male colleagues.
When I go out on a shoot, I never think that I'm a girl. When I go out, I'm a professional. I go with the mindset that gender doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is my profession. I've never prioritized my gender over my profession.
Photojournalist Masrat Zahra agrees. She says with the right support, no amount of societal pressure can hold women back from pursuing their passion.
Girls can make progress in any field, but need their parents' support for it. As long as your parents are supporting you, the society will never be able to stop you. Nothing can instill fear in you.
Zahra and Irshad are graduates of Kashmir University's journalism program. Both believe that despite the obstacles they face, women around the world are working hard to collectively break the social boundaries created by a male-dominated society.
It's a message that a woman can do wonders.
For Yusuf Jamil in Srinagar, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
This news alert from VOA Asia, U.S. President Donald Trump said negotiations with North Korea over the nation's nuclear weapons program are doing well, but an ongoing trade dispute with China is getting in the way. A powerful undersea earthquake with a magnitude of 7.1 struck on Wednesday near New Caledonia in the South Pacific, creating small tsunami waves, but no initial reports of damage. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. President Donald Trump has followed through on pledges to roll back Obama-era rules that tighten restrictions on greenhouse gases, promising the moves would lead to more American jobs and economic growth. Trump's proposal includes loosening restrictions to the American Clean Car Standards and the Clean Power Plan. White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara has more on that.
Charleston, West Virginia is coal country. The state has 150 coal mines and 15,000 coal mining jobs, the most in the nation.
Immediately after the election, it's just like boom, you know, with the coal industry. It started picking up. He got his job back. We got to keep her home. We got two new vehicles now. Pay your bills every day. Buy groceries with no problem. I mean, it's a totally different life now than it was through the Obama administration.
Michelle Abbott's husband, Kevin, has been mining for 32 years. He says President Trump's policies helped reopen the mine and put him back to work.
I'm tickled to death. Pays went up. The mining industry's gotten better. So everything's looking real good as far as mining goes.
The Abbotts attended a recent Trump rally in Charleston, where the president announced his plan to roll back the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan.
We are putting our great coal miners back to work.
Trump's proposal would allow coal-producing states to set its own limits on greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power plants. It abandons Obama-era goals to reduce carbon emissions from the nation's power plants by one-third by 2030. The West Virginia Coal Association supports Trump's coal-friendly policies.
Since President Trump took office, we've added about 3,000 direct mining jobs.
But environmental activists denounce them.
It's hard to see this as anything else than an abandonment of EPA's responsibility to limit climate pollution under the Clean Air Act and to really protect Americans from all the harmful consequences of climate change.
The Clean Power Plan was blocked by the Supreme Court in early 2016 and never implemented. Yet West Virginians blamed President Obama for the decline of the coal industry. In his last year in office, Obama's approval rating in the state was 24%, the lowest in the nation.
I think a big and a fair criticism of the Obama administration is they weren't here. And when you saw things like the Clean Power Plan, you know, there were no public hearings here. And so I think that people got this feeling that they weren't being heard, which I think carries a lot of weight. Here.
Given that there are cheaper and cleaner energy sources like natural gas and that the cost of renewable energy like solar and wind continue to drop, analysts believe Trump's proposal is driven more by political rather than economic considerations. In West Virginia, Trump's approval ratings are almost always above the national average.
I think a lot of this is politics, without also noting that I do think that as the power sector transitions away from coal, there are communities that could potentially be left behind in any sort of transition. And I do think it's important to consider that when making these policies.
There are less than 60,000 American coal jobs, about a tenth of jobs in renewable energy. To these miners, those jobs are their livelihood. And for Trump, these miners are a source of support. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News, West Virginia.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com, and we'd love to hear from you, VOA Asia Facebook, and our email at voaasia.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Greg Burns, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a great night.